Check AustinFilmFestival.com for information on our upcoming Black Friday badge sale, November 28th, 2014. Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is presented by Final Draft, the industry standard number one selling screenwriting software in the world, with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. For more info, go to finaldraft.com. Today, on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, screenwriter John Ridley.
I've always loved history. I've always loved things that were about something that it revealed something about ourselves without being preachy, being in the moment, making people see and feel perspectives that weren't necessarily represented.
John Ridley's credits include the novels Those Who Walk in Darkness, A Conversation with the Man, and Stray Dogs, the graphic novel The American Way, and the screenplays for the films Red Tails, U-Turn, Three Kings, and Undercover Brother. His script for 12 Years a Slave won the 2014 Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay, and he's currently the showrunner for the much-anticipated ABC series American Crime, which is due to premiere in 2015. This conversation was moderated by screenwriter and Austin Film Festival favorite, Alvaro Rodriguez.
Thank you so much for bringing television production to Austin. First of all, as you mentioned, you know, that you had a very welcoming experience here, which is always great to hear. Austin, I think, prides itself on being a little bit of a film hub and television hub now. The show I'm currently writing on From Dusk Till Dawn, although it's written in California, is shot also entirely here in Austin, so I'm glad about that. We're the same guy. That's what I'm trying to say. We're the same guy.
Essential.
Like, you wrote a movie called Three Kings with George Clooney. I am writing on a television series based on From Dusk Till Dawn with George Clooney.
One degree of separation.
Same guy. Star of American Crime, one of the lead characters, is played by Timothy Hutton.
Correct.
I had a major boy crush on Timothy Hutton as a child. We're the same guy. I was just probably start at the beginning. What was the genesis for you? Were you always a writer? Did you grow up writing? What was the thing that drew you to all this stuff in the first place?
Well, before I begin, first of all, thank you very much for taking the time to come and moderate. My thanks to the film festival, which actually have asked me a couple of years to come, and I couldn't work it out in my schedule. So the fact that they're not just asking this year, but had been interested in writers and writing for years really means a lot to me. And a very special thank you to everybody in Austin. As you said, this community down here is amazing. It's vibrant. You know, you're moving a production down here. You're not sure what to expect. But the level of craftsmanship, the environment, the desire it's as good as almost anywhere that you would find. And that's a big testament to the crew we have, because it really is one thing to sit and write and create something. It's something else to deliver that to folks and expect them to deliver on a high level week in and week out. So we've been down here since March. So in every regard, it's an absolutely spectacular community. It's been welcoming and inviting, and I appreciate that deeply. In terms of where it began, I don't know. I mean, when I was growing up, I did not like to read. I was very blessed. I had parents who could not just afford me a decent education, but insisted upon being educated and being well-read. But when your parents insist on things like that, you generally run in the other direction. And it wasn't honestly until high school that I picked up a book and I said, I'm going to start reading. You know, this is high school. And deep in, I was probably a sophomore. And the first book I read was Hounds of the Baskerville. And I don't know, I just figured,
we are the same guy. The first book I ever saved my money to buy was a hardcover copy of The Complete Sherlock Holmes, which I cost $20.
Wow. But doesn't it? It just transports you.
Transports you.
It was deep. It was rich. It was compelling. It was just one of those things that you hear about it. You're supposed to read it. Sherlock Holmes. I was always interested in mysteries and thrillers to a degree, and read it. And it's just the nuance and the detail and those things really compelled me. It wasn't writing that forced you at a distance. It was writing that, even though it was elevated, it really invited you in. Absolutely. And so I started going to bookstores, and I remember the big thing for me. I was going to bookstores, and I was trying. What do I read? And I pulled out it was a paperback copy of Farewell, My Lovely, Raymond Chandler. And somebody had written a blurb on the back that just had said, Raymond Chandler writes like an angel slumming. And I just read the blurb and I said, well, I need to find out what an angel slumming writes like. And that, honestly, for me, was like the first hit on the crack pipe. It was just, it was a very muscular type of writing, but sensitive. It was like a sensitive thug writing. And the way he talked about the city of Los Angeles, the way he talked about relationships, I mean, very, you know, particularly when you're high school, you know, very kind of machoism, but at the same time, it left a little bit of, you know, it's that kind of writing where it leaves a little bit of sensitivity and feeling. And that really was the cascade effect. That's what got me into writing mystery and crime and genre fiction. And that, of course, was just later in life. That's just where it really took off for me.
Which led to the novel Stray Dogs?
Stray Dogs was the first novel
and
I wrote.
Which became the Oliver Stone film U-Turn, is that correct?
It was very weird to write your first novel and to have a house read it and really like it. And it was in the late 90s, and at that time there was a revolution in sort of kind of hipster filmmaking. Obviously at the very top of that list, Quentin Tarantino. Right. Robert,
absolutely.
You know, people like that who are making these really interesting films.
And the resurgence
Oliver Stone.
Of the film noir is a genre.
Yeah, kind of the neo-noir, the kind of what they were calling kind of scuzz films at that time.
Oh,
but
nice.
They were films that were meant to be literate, meant to be in ways homage to writers of the past and film styles of the past. And so I just happened to be at the right place at the right time with your first novel. Oliver Stone reads it, makes this film that had Jennifer Lopez, Nick Nolte, Sean Penn, Claire Danes, Joaquin Phoenix, Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
I mean, basically just this roster of individuals. And from that spelled in my first screenplay was the screenplay that became Three Kings, that was David O. Russell. So it was the right time, right place with that kind of vibe that I just, you know, you trip into. You can work hard all your life, but sometimes it is about being the right time, right place, and around the right people. That's just the way it works.
And so describe the transformation, describe the evolution. You continue to write sort of these kind of crime novels like Everybody Smokes in Hell and things like that, and then the novel started also to change a little bit with a little bit more of a science fiction or a little bit of a fantastic element in some of these, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And it was very odd because I think when you're home alone by yourself, you kind of game plan your life. And it would be so nice if you could, you know, throw a touchdown pass the first time you get called onto the field. But, you know, the reality is you don't do that. And then you throw a pass and it's not quite a touchdown pass, but, you know, it's like on the opponent's 30-yard line. And it's really pretty amazing. But while on the one hand it feels really good, on the other hand, there's still that level of you're not there, not just in your mind, but, you know, the movies did well and there was an audience, but they weren't these films that just took over
right.
with a big cultural density. But at the same time, people think, well, you're sort of this hipster writer, and I certainly liked it, but I just like telling stories. And so I did start writing the science fiction series, Those Who Walk in Darkness,
right. And
What Fire Cannot Burn, and I wrote a story about a comedian in the 1950s, a black comedian in the 1950s called The Conversation with the Man.
Right.
And so it sort of took me in another direction. It was great, it was liberating, it was freeing, but in the film space, you were still sort of that guy.
Yeah, I was going to ask, were there people who were trying to keep you? You're that guy, you're the U-Turn guy, or you're the Three Kings guy.
I mean, the problem was the guy who was trying to keep me, that was me. I don't know if you've ever seen Rod Serling's The Velvet Alley. You know, people think of him as the Twilight Zone writer. You also have to think of him, wrote 7 Days in May, Planet of
Patterns,
the Apes, Patterns.
Repping for Heavyweight.
The Man, which was about the first black president in the 1960s, was amazing. These are just, you know, people think he's a great writer. He's not a great writer. He's a phenomenal writer.
Right.
He had written a TV teleplay that was basically his life story. It was about a guy played by Art Carney in his middle age who could not get a break. And he sells a script to live television, and it's a huge hit. And he gets into the system, and a lot of it is about him in that system. But there's also an executive played by Leslie Nielsen in a very dramatic role. You think of, you know, Leslie Nielsen now, Naked Gun and Airplane. Leslie Nielsen was a terrific dramatic actor, and he plays this executive who's always on the edge of being fired. You know, 60 years later, nothing has changed.
Right.
And people bag on executives. It's not an easy job to basically sit and play roulette all day, every day, with the house's money, and you don't score, the house wants you out. But he has this amazing line. He talks about how you give up your freedom in creativity. And he says, and this is in $1956 dollars, but he says, you know how they get you? They get you by paying you $1,000 a week. And you get to the point in your life where you need to live on $1,000 a week.
Right.
And that's when they own you. You know, again, 1956, you know, at that point in my career, it's probably about 2005. And, you know, you're still kind of young. You know, people are throwing checks at you. Just do another Undercover Brother. Do another Three right. Kings. Do something hipster, this and that. But those films were not exactly breaking through. So what do? Do you take that money and, okay, you know, there are worse things in life? Or do you say, this isn't working for me? That was a great space when I was in my early 20s. You know, I'm getting to be my mid-30s. It's just not me. I'm not one of those guys who can sustain it and sustain it in an amazing way. So about 2007, I mean, look, everything changed for everybody in 2007. I mean, life shut down. The industry definitely shut down. Everybody was moving to the franchise model. It was Marvel. It was DC. It was those kinds of things. And you had a few men and women at the very top who were getting those jobs. And you had everybody else who was hustling for what remained of a living. It was tough in every space, in every sector of the economy, obviously, and it was tough out there. And I really, and this was not me sitting and aggrandizing about me or what I thought I could do, it was just, look, I can chase these things with everybody else, and it's going to be tough because you're not even on that list of people, or you can start doing the things that you're really, really interested in. And I was very fortunate because I'd been working with Spike Lee on some things, and I wrote a script about the LA riots. I've always loved history. I've always loved things that were about something, you know, very different than those kind of hipster films, which were great and fun.
Right.
Something that it revealed something about ourselves without being preachy, being in the moment, making people see and feel perspectives that weren't necessarily represented. And also about a time in history, particularly about the LA riots, people thought it was Rodney King and Reginald Denny. And we saw the video, it was a black man being beaten, it was a white man getting retribution, and that was the story. And it was so much more complex, as these stories always are. And wrote that script, and has not been made to this day, but it was the beginning of a real change for me. It was a script that ended up on the blacklist at that time when the blacklist was still like underground and kind of really, you know, ooh, if you were on that list, how did you end up on that? You know,
right.
who are you? And it was the beginning of a slight reinvention. And then I got to do Red Tails with George Lucas, which was, you know, to work with George Lucas, to have a independent film that one guy was writing a check for, and I'm not going to say how much it was, but in the tens of millions. I mean, that was a whole different kind of indie film, but it's George Lucas, and working outside of a studio system and doing the film he wanted to do the way he wanted to do it. And then two things really happened. There was a story I'd been chasing for a long time that I was exceptionally passionate about, that I thought was beautiful and unexpected and unknown, about Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
And I just said, I'm making this film. I don't know how, I'm making this film. And the other thing was, somebody presented a memoir to me, 12 years. I just have to tell you, it was the most amazing book I'd ever read. And I really felt like I'd come full circle, you know, from not wanting to read to really reading something that changed my life. It was just beautiful. And with other people, I said, we are making this film, and we are going to tell this gentleman's story. It deserves to be told. I didn't know that the film would be that good, that Steve would put that much care in it, that Brad Pitt would put his life in it. But you do get to a point where you're around people who just want to do something because they want to do it. And that's, you know, that's what changed over the last bunch of years.
Finding a universal message in historical events and the therapeutic art of writing.
The past, whether it's, you know, I mean, honestly, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 40 years, you know, it is vibrant, it's alive. And, you know, there are obviously the old saws about, if you don't learn from the past, you're going to repeat it. But I think more than just learning from the past, it's really understanding how we arrived as people. You know, we have, as difficult as circumstances may seem, whether it's in this country, whether it's around the world, you look at the arc of us, And it's been phenomenal. You know, you look around this room and you see so many different kinds of people. You know, it wasn't that long ago, we couldn't come together like this and talk like this and share like this. That in and of itself is phenomenal. So I think it's one thing to say the history, you know, much like Baskervilles in a way, obviously that was fiction, but it's about making things relevant. So it's not just old England, it's not just talking about swamps and bogs and things like that, but it's about feeling something in the moment, about curiosity, about fear, about being thrilled. And those are the things that are in history that excite us. You know, it's those moments. I mean, look, entertainment is, it's an empathy machine. You know, we're not here to just make pronouncements about things or to dictate. If that's what we're here to do, you know, the world would be even more advanced in terms of, you know, where we are, because there is so much cinema and TV and books and things like that. Right. It's not about trying to dictate to individuals, here's how you should feel and here's how you should think and here's my big idea about the past. It's about, can you feel something? Can you put yourself in a place? And these films that you see about so many different subject matters, whether they're of great imports or whether they're small, delicate pieces that just move you, that you forget that you're in your room watching TV, you forget you're in a theater, you forget the people around you, and you just, whatever, your gut clenches, your heart opens, or the tears flow. That's what we're here to do. So if we can take the past and make it present, like you're saying, mm-hmm. if we can take emotion that seems like it's coming from another side of the country, around the world, and make people in their space feel that same thing, that's what I think we're here to do.
The coupling of the two words, the empathy machine, that strikes a deep chord with me. I didn't expect this was be a therapeutic conversation with John.
It's all right. We're all going to be okay. But writing, you know, I say writing to me has always been therapeutic. It's always
writing
been that kind of thing. And I tell people, and they say, oh, you know, I want to know about writing or this and that. You know, it, like anything else, would you do it because it's who you are? Would you put those stories down? You know, Chris McQuarrie said something to me, and he's a phenomenal writer, again, but a guy who just drops things that are incredibly sage. And he said about writing, it is a constant struggle to... because it is a personal thing, because whether you're literally calling people out in your family or whatever, or you're just drawing things from your life experience or things that you've heard or experience that you had, you're always out there. You're hurting people who you love to impress people that you'll never meet. You know, that's basically what writing is. You're taking stories and situations that are very near and dear to you, and you're putting them out there hoping that, you know, somebody in Milwaukee, somebody in Boston, somebody in Miami will watch the show or read the book or pay money to see a movie and, you know, come out of it and say, I was all right. You know, the third act kind of sucked, but it was all right. You know? You know, that's what that constant struggle is. Right. And you get up and would you do that whether you're getting the check or not, whether it's going to end up in a theater or not? And if you're going to do that, then yes, you are a writer. And writing is unique in that there are amazing actors out there, great, great actors, but they got to wait for that story to come to them. Great directors have to wait for that story. A writer can go and write. You know, you can get up in the morning. It's, you know, not to go too far off in the tangent, but it's the difference between... Some read a long time ago, somebody said, what's the difference between Superman and Batman? And the difference is that, you know, Batman, Bruce Wayne has to put on the costume to be Batman. Superman wakes up in the morning, he's Superman. That's it. He's got to put on a costume to be regular. And when you wake up in the morning as a writer, you have an opportunity to be heroic, to tell a heroic story in any way, shape, or form. And everyone else, as great as they are, as much as they contribute, as vital as they are, because you cannot do it without this team of people, you know, they've got to wait for that story to come out there. So for all of those individuals who are writers, who aspire to be writers, you know, it's not about the check. It's not about going to Hollywood or somewhere in Austin or wherever. It's waking up in the morning saying, you know, I'm a writer. That's it. I'm right. Doing it.
Approaching biopics, creating original material, and 12 Years a Slave.
To me, explaining writing is like explaining a car. I don't know how my car works. I get in the morning and it takes me somewhere. And that's all you can do is just get into the subject matter, and it takes you. And I've been presented with history books or subject matter, particularly over the last few years, with L.A. Riots, with 12 Years, with Hendrix, and all that. And they're like, oh, you're now, you know, it's switched. Now you're the history guy. You know, forget about those other films. And they're things you read, and they're interesting, but they don't quite grab you. They don't necessarily make you want to dig further. And I think the thing is now audiences are so much sharper and shrewder and more mature and expect more and have access to more information. And you can't just sort of put things out the way perhaps we could have, you know, even 5 years ago, where, okay, here's your slice of history. And you look at films like Lincoln, where the concept is we were going to show you Lincoln in 2 hours of the Emancipation Proclamation. That's pretty amazing. And it gives you ultimately more perspective than, you know, you got that much time in Springfield and you got that much time in Congress. Right. Same with 42, the Jackie Robinson biopic, you know, just his rookie season. And it really tells you so much more about the man, the struggle, the time period, the people who rallied around them, the people who stood against him, than sort of cherry picking through history. So I think in terms of presenting it, more than anything else, it really is taking the opportunity to dig more deeply. The expectations are higher. The capacity for people to call one out in terms of facts or perceived facts or what is added, what is removed, it's there. And I think it's driving those hysterical narratives in a way that has not been done before. But I think it's great. I think it's great for audiences because they are entertained, they are informed to a degree. It's a film. It is never going to be true history. Of course, we'll probably never know what true history really is. Right. It's always written by someone or some group of individuals. But I do think those films now are closer to a level of honesty, or at least emotional honesty, than they were even a short time ago.
And so I think in some ways it illustrates that sort of transformation of the biopic instead of, you know, it is something like a birth to death thing to something like My Week with Marilyn, which becomes a very contained story that gives you so much about the characters and these personalities or whatever, these historical figures, but puts it in a space that we can really breathe in and inhabit and all of those kinds of things.
I think that's a great example. And really, what I really liked about My Week with Marilyn, it was about that fight at that time between method acting and more traditional stage acting. I think it was interesting. That was a bit of the story that seemed lost on people. And I thought that was really, really interesting that you have this individual who is so representative of that style of acting at that time, working with Laurence Olivier, who was, you know, the model of those are the words, you go out and act. And it was a very powerful story in that regard. But I think, yes, taking 1 week and looking at her life and people around her and a real event, the making of that film, was very, very, it was clever, it was bright. It was a really interesting way of doing things, and something certainly we appropriated with Always By My Side, where it was just 1 year in the life of Jimi Hendrix. It was not meant to try to just take slices of 27 years.
Right.
How much can we say about 1 year in the life of this individual? And again, I think a story that, look, for these stories to be relevant, I think they've got to be informative. And if you're just telling people what they already know, what's the point?
Even before the writing begins, what's your process and what draws you to these things?
That's a really good question, and it's two things. It's generally, it's a fantastic question. One is, as I said, a little bit is just in somebody pitching you the material or something being presented to you, does it in some way just, you know, is a fire lit? I mean, you just feel it like, oh, I want to, you know, I've read that one piece of it, I want to read more, I want to learn more, I want to dig more deeply. And yes, if you want to go to school in the morning, you're going to the right school. So whatever that subject matter is and you feel like you want to get into it a little bit more, that's the way to go. The other thing for me is when there is a piece of subject matter, and certainly over the last couple of years with these pieces that I've worked on, is there one piece of material, a book, that someone has written in particular that is going to be the cornerstone of your research. And I love to get it as a book, not on an iPad, nothing against iPads. I work on them constantly, but an old school book, again, a piece of, you know, those things that people dispense in life that stick with you. I was very fortunate. I went to NYU. It's a great school. I did not go to film school there, but I went to school. And wonderful education. I could not tell you half the things that I learned, but one of the things that one of my professors told me that has always stuck with me, said, if you're not reading with a highlighter in your hand, you're not reading. And when there is a subject matter or a book that I find that I love, and it's just, it is highlighted, whatever that is, dog-eared, posted, noted it up, bent, the binding is coming apart, I am scared to death if I lose it, I'll have to start all over again. When that book, I'm serious, and part of it, the reason I want to carry it around, I want to be afraid to lose it, because that means I'm working now.
Right.
I'm working and I have to keep this near me and I want to go back to that one thing. And I'm telling you, those among many source materials, but if you went and I have these books that I've worked from for 12 years, and obviously Solomon's memoir, but many of the Hendrix books and from the LA riots, and I keep them because it just, there's a pride. They are torn apart. And when one does that, I think you feel like, okay, now I'm working. Now I've got this thing. You know, I'm carrying that nuclear football, and I got to hold on to it. That's when I feel like this is obviously a subject matter that I feel very, very passionate about. And it, there is a nice feeling that once you go to script, you've got this thing that you can just go back and forth on. And for a moment, you know, you become the expert, and you go to cocktail parties, and you hope people bring up, you know, the Tuskegee Airmen. You just, you know, cocktail party. Going, yeah, you know, World War II was interesting, wasn't it? That was an interesting time in our history. What Tuskegee Airmen? Let me tell you about those guys. Yeah. You know, you're that person for a moment, and there's a nice feeling about that. And again, it goes back to when I was a kid in school and didn't want to read, didn't want to learn, didn't want to know, and you find this thing in yourself where you there's something that I have,
right.
And I'm something that you're passionate about, and it's a very nice feeling. It really is.
How is the process different when you're just inventing a complete new story that's not based on existing material?
It's certainly, and I'm not talking about me or my work, but it was very interesting this year. Certainly above any other year, because you're in the mix, and it comes to the end of the year and the films get segregated by adapted and original screenplay, and right. Certainly in the adapted, phenomenal work that's in the mix, and you're already feeling like, you know, somehow you trip behind the velvet rope and the bouncer didn't see you and you got to go in. But at the same time, you're looking over here and films and screenplays like Nebraska,
right.
Which were just small and simple, and somebody just taking, you know, the road trip with your dad that's been done 1,000 times, they do it 1,001st time, and it's just different, and it's special,
yeah.
And it touches. Her, probably my favorite film from last year. Again, just technology and falling in love with your computer. We've seen that, but we haven't seen it with so much heart and
right.
So much nuance and so much simplicity and so much beauty. Really.
Right.
So I looked at those films and I kept thinking, well, you know, it's hard to go wrong when you have Solomon's memoir. You
right.
know, it's just, you're working from something that had so much feeling and so much emotion and so much drive. And I say it not in a self-effacing way, but truly, I think the headline would have been, you know, writer fucked that up, would have been the headline. Because you read it and it's there. It took work. I'm not pretending that, you know, there wasn't work involved, but it was so potent and so powerful. And you look at what folks are doing across the aisle in the original category, and you go, man, somebody just sat and just mused and created and brought things together that didn't exist. And you think, well, that, you know, those guys over there are doing something. Those men and women have put something together. So I've been away from that space from a little bit.
Right.
Certainly American Crime, kind of a nice hybrid of taking things that are real in society right now, but at the same time bringing some dramatic narrative. But it was a very odd set of circumstances, being at the end of the year, and people very praiseful of what you're doing, but knowing that, you know, you got to praise Solomon. And there's another group of individuals over here who just sat and caught fire, and it was pretty amazing. For me, there has to be a comfort level with the subject matter before at least I felt ready to go into it. So with 12 Years a Slave, there was so much that was presented in Solomon's memoir, but there were a lot of things. I mean, look, I thought, particularly as a person of color in America, you think you have an understanding of slavery that may be different from other folks just because of your lineage. I didn't know anything about slavery. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about the transformation from indentured servitude to indentured servitude based on racial concepts to racial inferiority being indoctrinated in America. I mean, we didn't start as a slave nation. Slavery didn't just show up here. It evolved. And when you see that evolution and you see the mass psychosis that was traded to all of us, you wonder why we still have problems and issues. The majority of the time in America is because, you know, honestly, a cadre of individuals. I mean, look, people in the North benefited from slavery. There was an economy, and I don't want to get on a high horse. You talk about not proselytizing, but look, I mean, there's a reality. We benefit today. You can call it slavery. You can call it trafficking. You can call it forced labor. You know, I'm standing here benefiting from those things. So you talk about putting things in the present. It's not about, you know, people would oftentimes, oh, why are you doing something about slavery? I know everything about slavery. You know, what do we know about right now? And it's about making, and again, I'm not trying to get on a high horse because I'm benefiting too, but at least understanding how that evolution happened to get where we were and how it's still happening and just making a choice. And you make those choices, just make informed choices. So for me, there was an educational process with Hendrix. I knew so much about 66, 67. You know, if I was at that cocktail party and somebody asked me about 1960, I had to shut up and go get another drink because I didn't know what I was talking about. But there was a level of understanding who this individual was and where he came from to get to that point. So I think you have to balance it with the knowledge, but I don't think you can kid yourself that I'm a historical expert. I don't think I could kid myself on being a historical expert. It just had to get to a point where I felt like I was, I had an understanding of many things that were going on.
Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival, the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission of the Arts, and is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com.